Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, August 3rd, our first show of the new month. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. There's a new law in New Jersey that says if you go to a restaurant, you're getting takeout. Mm-hmm. They can't just give you plastic utensils anymore.
Nope.
You got to ask for them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many laws that have popped up in recent years to try to reduce our plastic consumption, our reliance on plastic. Plastic is everywhere, Cherry.
Yeah, it is.
And sometimes it feels like we're really not making a whole lot of progress in our quest to reduce plastic usage. We know that plastic has a real effect on our environment. You know, it doesn't mm-hmm. break down when you throw it away. There's microplastics in our water, and we're still studying the health effects of all that. And so today on the show, we're going to talk about whether there are things we can do that we're not doing to reduce our own plastic usage, to mm-hmm. reduce plastic structurally. We're going to ask how we got here with plastic, and we're going to ask you, how does your household think about plastic? Have you tried reducing your plastic usage? Give us your war stories. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And by the way, this is a safe space. I mean, because there might be people who may not have been as intentional as they would have liked. They may not have sat down and actually thought about their reducing this. But this is your moment, right?
This is your moment.
This is the moment.
You didn't know the moment was coming. Here it is.
Here it is. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. I'd love to hear from you.
Have you reduced your plastic usage?
You
said it was a safe space.
It's a safe space. I have, but I could do better. And I need to be more intentional about it. That's why I wanted to open the door for people who may be like me. I did, you know, I gave up the bottled water. I
you
have
did.
My cup.
That's kind of why I brought
step,
it up.
But I need to do better. Like, I could do better.
Right. But don't be too hard on yourself.
Yeah. But, and so this is a moment, I think, where we all need to come together and just really be more intentional.
Okay. 888-477-9499. Be intentional. Call the show. Also email us, studio2@whyy.org. Speaking of New Jersey, we will start there our trio of local news stories. Cherry, take it away.
Yeah, Republican lawmakers in New Jersey, they see an opening for getting a voter ID law passed in the Garden State. The momentum shift comes after Governor Mikey Sherrill publicly stated that she would be open to signing a voter ID law if one came to her desk. The governor's remarks, of course, come days after announcing that thousands of non-citizens were erroneously registered to vote in New Jersey due to a glitch in software used by the MVA. 400 actually voted by mistake. That incident is under investigation. But that revelation that led to GOP complaints about voter fraud in New Jersey and nationwide, and state GOP lawmakers, they had introduced a voter ID bill three times since 2022, but it stalled without even getting to a committee hearing. And so now they feel like that could change. The proposed bill would require voters to show an ID, a driver's license, a real ID, or a passport, among other options. And if they didn't have that, they could show two pieces of mail, like a utility bill or mail from a government agency. And if they couldn't meet either of those requirements, they could be subject to a challenge. What was interesting about Sherrill's comments is that she made it clear she's okay with a voter ID bill, but not with the SAVE Act, which is the bill being pushed by President Donald Trump. She called the SAVE Act a voter suppression piece of legislation, specifically because it would require the use of a national database to verify citizenship. And a lot of states are against that. Shout out to the New Jersey Monitor for this story. And of course, tomorrow on the show, Avi, we will be talking about election integrity, the SAVE Act, and the political battle over voting. Yep. So all of this is sort of bubbling to the surface at the same time.
Also, shout out News 12, because she made those comments on one of their programs.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting comment. And so clearly there's openness, but like with anything, if you say you're open to a voter ID law, the devil's in the details.
What does voter ID mean
to people these days? It's all over the place. But clearly the political window has started to shift on this topic. You can mm-hmm. absolutely feel it. It's been shifting for several years now. And you're seeing more Democrats. It's not just Sherrill say, yes, we're okay with certain things and not certain other things. And where those battle lines will be drawn ultimately will be interesting. But New Jersey is an interesting test case, mm-hmm. in part because it's a solidly blue state. It's a blue trifecta state. And so if a bill could move and get through in New Jersey, I think it would signal that we're in a somewhat new phase of this conversation.
And they're also dealing with the backlash of this era. So, sure. Yeah.
Story number two. Okay. Mm-hmm. You've heard of snakes on a plane, Sherry.
I have.
But have you heard of snakes on a nationally preserved historic site? Pause for laugh. whatever.
Go right ahead.
The Enquirer reports mm-hmm. that a 46-foot granite statue depicting Ben Franklin's famous Join or Die snake will hopefully be installed this fall on Independence Mall near the corner of 5th and Chestnut. As you probably know, because you're a big history buff, Franklin drew a political cartoon in 1754 of a snake cut into pieces, with each piece representing an American colony under the snake. It said, "Join or Die." It was a call for unity. It was actually sort of a call for unity against the French, who would then help us in the war for independence. Mm-hmm. But let's put that aside for a second. The idea of turning that cartoon into a statue has actually been around for a while, since the early 2000s. But now it seems to actually be happening. So far, the Independence Historical Trust has raised about $4 million for the project. Mm-hmm. They still need about $600,000 more to actually install the statue. So they've set up a public fundraising page, but they seem hopeful, according to the reporting, that this statue, after a long and winding snake-like history, will finally slither its way onto the mall sometime this year.
You're so punny.
Wait, that was not that punny.
I'm just saying. I like the way you threw that in there. I'm complimenting you.
Wasn't that punny. I can be punny. Don't challenge me. Anyways, so did you just see the mock-ups for the statue?
I did, and it looks really cool. Yep. And of course, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, this was one of the projects that was supposed to be completed in time for the 250th sure. anniversary, but because of funding cuts, that did not happen. But it's kind of cool to see that there's still momentum to get this done, and I'm glad it's not too late. And as an aside, I don't know, we're both from the D.C. area, but I don't know if you remember that big sculpture that used to be at Haynes Point. It was called The Awakening. It was like a giant sort of coming out of the earth, and they moved it now to the National Harbor. It sort of reminds me of that. It's like a several pieces of the same thing.
Just yeah. as a piece of art,
as a piece of art, it reminds me.
Not that
me.
Ben Franklin had anything to do with the giant.
No,
guy.
No. But
he
it's
was
just
a big
kinda,
guy. But
it's like art that sort of makes you want to go touch it and engage
interact
with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think this piece of art will do. And people who, you know, you think, I've been down to Independence Mall, I don't need to go again. Well, this will make people want to go again.
Sure, we got enough statues of people. Let's put a snake up there.
Let's put a snake. And it represents something.
Maybe more animals. I don't know.
One of the first, you know, political cartoons. So anyway, look forward to seeing that happen. No date yet, but fingers crossed.
I guess this is a pro snake show is what we have determined.
Yeah. Yes, we have. Third story, heartwarming story alert, people. Every so often, we hear about a car careening on Kelly Drive and crashing into the Schuylkill River. Well, that happened on July 10th when 62-year-old Brian Moses was having an emergency and lost control of his vehicle. It just so happens that Libby Peters, a former elite rower with the U.S. Women's National Team, she happened to be on the banks of the river shooting a documentary. When she heard and saw the car crash into the water, she leapt into action, diving into the river. She swam 100 yards to pull Moses out of the car. Here's a clip of his exclusive interview with CBS Philly. Take a listen.
I grabbed her hand. I said, "You my angel," while I was holding on the boat. I said, "Don't leave me." And here we are today.
Here we are.
And they're hugging and crying and everything. Peter says she had been thinking of Moses for the past few weeks, and they recently reunited. They hugged, and Moses expressed gratitude. And, of course, Peter's big question was, how did Moses end up crashing? Because you always want to know, how did they end up? How did this happen? He said his foot was swollen from an earlier injury. It got lodged under the pedals in his car, so the gas and brake pedal.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, and he looked down, trying to dislodge his foot, trying to free his foot. He lost control of the car and, boom, went into the Schuylkill River. But Peter's quick action saved his life. What a great story by CBS3. And, you know, she was a rower. Like,
thank
who,
God.
And happened to be right there at that exact moment. And it just goes to show his fate.
Absolutely. Rowers are jacked, by the way.
They so strong. And this guy was not a small man. You underestimate rowers
because they're like sitting down. You know what I mean? And they're in the boat. But then you see them get out of the boat. You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Rowers are yoked.
Yeah. And she
did. She swam 100 yards before she even rescued him.
Yeah. And then.
That's a football
field. And, of course, people came and assisted her once she brought him to the surface. Sure. But she is a cancer survivor. This woman. And he wasn't a small man. She jumped in there without thinking. Kudos to Libby Peters.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm so glad Moses made it out. Yeah.
Absolutely. Nice story. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue the show on the other side of this break talking about plastic usage. And we want to know from you, how does your household think about plastic? Have you tried to reduce your plastic usage? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Plastics are everywhere. They're bad for the planet and our health, but they're also convenient, durable, and cheap, making them hard to avoid.
Trying to find alternatives can be tricky and oftentimes more expensive, but is it worth the effort? What policy and personal changes can we make to reduce our plastic footprint?
We have three guests this hour joining us to discuss. In studio, we have Alisa Shargorodsky, Director of Ecosystems, a Philly-based nonprofit focusing on reuse and reducing waste in food packaging. Alisa, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also in studio is Maury Cohen, professor at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and editor of the journal Sustainability, Science, Practice, and Policy. Maury, thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, we're joined on the line by Jenna Jambeck, professor of environmental engineering at the University of Georgia and a 2022 MacArthur Fellow for her work investigating plastic pollution. Jenna, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, and of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners on the road, online, elsewhere. How does your household think about plastic? Have you tried reducing your usage? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And then for our folks on Facebook and YouTube, you can put those comments in the live chat.
Hey, let's start with a caller. Let's bring in Tom from King of Prussia, who's on line one. Hey, Tom, you're kicking us off today. What are your thoughts on plastic usage?
Plastic usage, what I feel is that in clothing, there is so many bits of plastic. Everything has different kinds of plastic in either clothes or towels or bedding or whatnot. None of that can get recycled, or nor does it.
Yeah.
So I think going back to more natural materials could help. And that stuff usually seems to break down and turn into the microplastics that you're seeing in the ocean and whatnot after being washed and what are going through treatment plants and put back out into the rivers.
Thanks, Tom.
So that's it. Yep,
yeah, thanks. So Tom's concerned about a plastic in clothing. So Jenna, how did we get here? How do we end up in a place where plastic is sort of in everything? And it's got to be in some ways a tribute to the qualities of plastic, but why is it everywhere?
Well, it is. Like you said, the qualities that make it so useful is it can be made into any shape. It can be any color. It's fairly inexpensive because of the fact that it's sourced from fossil fuels and we're already refining fossil fuels for other reasons. And so in some ways, it's almost a byproduct of that process. And so because of that, it really has become useful. It's changed the car industry, the aviation industry, electronics. You know, it really kind of just snuck into our lives in many ways and changed everything. And it's really hard to go back from that. But because of its ubiquitous use, and the fact that we lagged behind in, I think, thinking about the waste management of it, that's how we ended up with a lot of it leaking out of our systems that weren't really designed or ready for the variety of products that we've seen.
Yeah. And Maury, when you hear that systems, I want to talk about this system that we've kind of created, whether knowingly or unknowingly, that it sort of has us locked into this place where plastic is I've thought about this chair has plastic pieces. I have plastic buttons on my shirt. There's this microphone has plastic. Just sort of talk about this system so that people understand how things move through it.
Well, I find it useful to turn back the clock. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the early 1970s when we first got off on this path of trying to recover and recycle materials. Curiously, we assigned responsibility to local and municipal governments. That recovery of materials, the reuse of materials, was regarded as an extension of the trash management system. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, I think that was a gross mistake, that we should have recognized at the time that giving responsibility, assigning responsibilities to the manufacturers who were putting those materials out into the world would provide a much more effective response than putting local government officials
Describe the system, though. So we had this system where the responsibility was put on local government, you said. So explain the system to us that has us sort of locked in to using plastics for almost everything.
Well, your question, I think, provides an opportunity to provide a more sociological interpretation, that one of the reasons why plastics have become so ubiquitous in our lives is because we have privileged certain aspects of our lives, namely ease, convenience, comfort. And until we begin to grapple, I think, a little bit more comprehensively with the reasons why plastics are so pervasive, we're unlikely to make very much progress in terms of reducing the overall volume that are part of our lives.
Yeah, let me read a comment from Jill, who agrees with much of what you're saying here, Maury. Jill says, since the crying Native American commercial campaign of the 70s, the onus has been placed on individuals and the public to recycle their plastic waste. The issue is that a lot of plastics aren't recyclable or only recyclable in very specific places. I believe this issue will only be solved when starting from the top with government regulations on companies that create plastic products, as well as those companies doing their part on their own to figure out how to curb plastic usage. So that gets me back to the point you're making first, Maury, which is that we focus too much of our energy in the wrong places. Is it possible to move to a world where we have the same level of convenience, the same level of consumption, but very, very little plastic? Or is that just impossible at all? Because we talk a lot about replacements for plastic. Well, you could lose glass for this instead of plastic. You could use bamboo for this instead of plastic. Is that the wrong paradigm to approach this whole problem with?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think much of our environmental conversation over the past 50 years and longer, you know, has been very much focused on issues of efficiency. And efficiency is an extremely powerful motivator, particularly for businesses, that we all want to be efficient in what we do. But what's been lost in much of the sustainability discussion over the last several decades is that another side of that coin is sufficiency, and that we're much less comfortable talking about sufficiency. What would be an appropriate amount of ease? What would be an appropriate amount of comfort? And so on and so forth. That we've sort of elevated these objectives to becoming so singularly important in contemporary lives that issues of frugality, issues of wise use, have largely fallen out of our vocabulary.
Let me give an example, see if it hits on the point you're making. Are you saying that the problem isn't that we are using plastic for our takeout containers? It's that we're having takeout food to begin with.
Well, then the question becomes, well, why do we have this explosion in takeout food? Well, from my perspective, the issue comes back to the fact we have people working long and irregular hours, that cooking and meal preparation are skills that are slowly falling out of the culture. And so takeout food is entering into that equation in order to solve a problem in the real day-to-day lives of ordinary people.
Yeah. Let me read a couple comments. Matt says, I've moved from glass food storage from plastic. However, I'm old enough to remember when we transitioned from glass to plastic in food products, and especially in grocery bags. It was sold to the public as saving trees. Today, people hear the opposite. Those typically older people can be forgiven for their cynicism about how plastics are bad. Let me bring in a caller. Emily from Hatfield is on the line. Emily, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So I've greatly reduced my plastic waste. I'm actually an archaeologist by career trade, so I've actually gone out there and dug up all the horrible plastic waste before I could actually get to the artifacts. So I've seen it as a major issue in my field of study. I actually own an earth-friendly plastic-free refill shop in Skipack, PA. It's in Montgomery County.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to help reduce all the plastic waste that I can. Yeah. We have refill on products like soaps and laundry detergent, all-purpose cleaners. You can bring in your own containers.
Wow.
So we're eliminating that whole plastic bottle refill in the stores.
I love it. Thank you. That's Emily from Hatfield doing her part. By the way, how does your household think about plastic? Have you tried reducing your usage? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And so before we bring Alisa into the conversation, Jenna, I wanted to circle back to you because I know people have an understanding of the waste that we talk about, but I want you to give us the real like viewpoint of how the pileup is happening for people who may not have an understanding of the scale. Because we talked about seeing plastic bags sort of floating around the city, maybe hanging from an electric pole or something like that. But this is a huge global problem, and I want you to scale it for us.
Sure. I just want to echo, Maury talking about this as a systems mm-hmm. problem. And I think it's really important to understand that. And a lot of the responsibility has been put on consumers and mm-hmm. responsibility for management on local entities that don't have the resources. So these new policies for extender producer responsibility that we're starting to see in a patchwork quilt across the U.S. are really kind of interesting in that regard. Hopefully we can talk more about that. But yeah, globally, we did some modeling work and looked at the quantity of plastic entering the ocean around the world, and that was equal to 8 million metric tons in that estimate. And that's equal to about a dump truck of plastic every minute going into the ocean. And so that's really the scale that we're talking about. But that can be overwhelming, so it's important for everyone to realize that, what you may do feels small, like just you getting rid of water bottles, for example. That one step, actually, if you think about it over a year, over your lifetime, and then just another person does that and another person does that, that collective action can make change. But again, this is a systems problem, so it's not like all those changes. We really need the whole systems to change so that we have more choice. And stores like Emily's are on every corner, access to everyone.
What is the single biggest input, Jenna, in terms of creating plastic waste? Because people, I think, would assume that it's the stuff that they use because that's what we see go into the trash. And mm-hmm. if you're on the beach, that might be what you see wash up. Is that the case? Is it individual consumer products?
Well, it is a lot of packaging. So 40% of plastics that are produced for single-use packaging. So it is a lot of that. But also in terms of ocean inputs, we have things like fishing gear. We have a lot of plastics that are used in construction materials. But tend to, like in terms of leakage, what we do see washing up or in our data, we collect data in cities around the world with our circularity assessment protocol. We often see these single-use packaging items. But again, the system is designed so that we want that convenience. That's the only thing we have access to. That's the only thing we can afford. And they just tend to leak out, especially film kind of plastics, wrappers, water bottle tops. You'll see in Europe now, they're actually attached, they're tethered to the bottles. So people have thought about these issues and how can we keep, you know, from losing them. But the better thing is to try not to use them in the first place.
And I want to ask you a quick follow-up, because Mary from Allentown says she wants to suggest using high-density bamboo containers, good alternative to styrofoam and plastic. But you talked about this system that sort of forces us and has us locked in. And I really want people to understand, like, we offer these alternatives, but the system is designed to keep us using plastics. And can you explain why that is the case?
Typically, it's expense. Styrofoam, like expanded polystyrene, those foam containers are they're not very much of the actual polymer. There's a lot of air in there, so they're actually really cheap. They're probably the least expensive container that you can use. And you know, small businesses often use those because it's what they can afford. Anything else is very expensive. And, you know, I think the margins in the food industry are very low anyway. Mm. And so I think that makes it very challenging to ask the consumer to pay more if you're going to try to offer these alternatives, although we are seeing consumers want these alternatives. So a lot of the people writing in and calling really want to see these. And that's one thing you can do. Communicate to companies, communicate to your restaurant that you'd like to see something else used if possible. Maybe you're willing to pay more.
Speaking of which, Nancy from Haddonfield says there are starting to be resale stores where you can bring in containers and fill up conditioner and soap. I go every week. I try to never buy single-use plastic. Hopefully more and more of these shops pop up. Alisa, I want to bring you into the conversation to talk about what alternatives do exist, because I know you work with some businesses as they try to transition, rely less on plastic. And when you're advising folks, like, what are the sort of go-to alternatives that seem to check enough of the boxes to be useful to a standard business?
That's a great question. So to talk a little bit more about what Maury said and to like back up a bit, I think that we have to think about how we've been enculturated into disposability. So when we're talking to businesses, a lot of times businesses might think that it's going to be more expensive for them to make transitions because they're using materials like polystyrene, when in reality, they might fail to realize that they're locked into this process where they're buying these materials consistently for all of time. They also are oftentimes paying to dispose of them, because like in Philadelphia, we have a lot of food service establishments that are serving their eat-in customers on disposable wares. And then they're purchasing these materials, and then they also have to pay to dispose of them. So we have a really exciting initiative called Philly Unwrapped. We've been working on this for several years, where we are attracting funds so that we can help businesses wean off of the disposability culture, especially for their eat-in customers. And how we do that is we work with other organizations. We work with the Sustainable Business Network of Greater Philadelphia, Clean Water Action, their Rethink Disposable Project, Trash Academy. And we've been hosting these events, but what we're showing businesses is that, and now Rethink Disposable has done like hundreds of case studies that show that the businesses that make these transitions, they save between $3,000 and $22,000 a year. Wow. So our organization is working really hard in environmental justice neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that don't have access to these transitions. We help them by providing them with some funding so that they can, we help them, we don't give them money, we give them reusable materials. Somebody mentioned bamboo. You know, bamboo, if you're thinking about transitioning to a bamboo product, that's going to be very expensive, and it's also going to result in waste. So whether it's an environmentally friendly product or not, you still have to consider like the road miles that go into transporting that, and nothing beats reuse. So we always just try to get businesses to think about like, what items are you using that you can modify to go towards a reusable? Obviously, if you're doing takeout, that becomes increasingly more difficult.
I wondered about, you know, where we have cities and municipalities sort of banning plastic bags for grocery stores. I remember that. Now, most people have switched to reusable bags. Now you see in New Jersey, they're banning single, offering single-use plastic, you know, for takeout and things like that. Do those work?
The research shows that they do. The skip the stuff laws that they're passing. I think that the traditionally, and obviously, like, you need oversight, and that's also expensive for municipalities to get people out, making sure that we're doing the thing that we're not allowed, or not doing the thing that we're not allowed to do, like bags. Even though we ban bags, there's still a lot of businesses still using plastic bags in the city. But what they're finding is that when you start to create these laws, it changes from like the go-to. So now when in New Jersey, where before you order your food takeout and they're putting tons of these utensils into a bag, now they're, you know, their boss is telling the employee, like, you can no longer do that. It has to be only upon request, or you cannot give them at all. So, you know, of course, then those businesses are spending less money on buying those utensils. Those utensils are not resulting in, you know, products that go into the waste stream. So, yeah, I do think that those do have an effect. But I think that we have to really think about this idea of convenience and how it's been sold to us to make businesses think like this is the better and easiest way.
Maury, you had something to add there?
Yeah, I just wanted to reflect. I just returned. My wife and I took a lengthy cross-country road trip in the last couple of weeks, and we just got back a few days ago. And I realize this is a local program. We're focused on what's going on at the local and regional level, and that's extremely important. But what was dismaying and extremely disappointing for me to discover on this trip is that large parts of the country have not only abandoned materials management of plastics, they've abandoned their entire recycling programs. And that particularly for areas that are sort of outside of metropolitan regions, we really seem to be 50 years behind.
Yeah. Actually, I was going to ask, have we made any sort of dent so far? Because the idea of sustainability, reuse, these are not completely new ideas.
No.
People have been talking about these maybe in niche circles for a long time. In terms of plastic consumption, plastic production, is there really any overall sense of progress, Maury?
Yeah. I mean, the data says one thing, and but I think our emotional engagement on this question, you know, speaks in a perhaps a slightly different way. I myself have been involved in this work for three decades, and perhaps it's a testament to the political circumstances in which we live at the moment. But I think there's a dismaying sense and a crisis of hope.
Yeah.
That environmental issues, that sustainability in the large sense, have kind of lost political and social salience for many people. And one would like to hope that, you know, these things move in decade-long cycles, and that perhaps we're preparing ourselves for.
But like our plastic dependence today is the same, worse than it was 10 years ago?
No, it's worse than it was 10 years ago. Yes.
And that is because of what? That is because more things that could be not plastic or plastic, or is it just because we're seeing, you know, more countries industrialized, that which means more convenience culture, which means more plastic use? Is that the main thing driving it, or what's the?
I think it's all of the above.
All of the above. Okay. Well, we're going to talk a lot more on the other side of this break about perhaps what we can do to change that trajectory. We have a couple callers waiting. We're going to get to you as well. I'm going to read this comment here from David in Upper Darby, who says, I do what I can at home. I try not to use plastic wrap or Tupperware. I use cloth shopping bags and generally try to stick to cotton. That's what David does to try to reduce plastic use. We're asking you that question today. How does your household think about plastic? Have you tried reducing your usage? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Hey
welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking about plastic this hour. It's everywhere in our lives, almost impossible to escape. While it's brought a lot of convenience, it's also causing serious environmental damage and has been linked to some health effects that scientists are still trying to unravel.
Yes, and let me reintroduce our guest this hour. We have Jenna Jambeck, Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Georgia, Maury Cohen, Professor at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and Elisa Shagorodsky, a Director of Ecosystems, a Philly-based nonprofit focusing on reuse and reducing waste.
We also have you with us. How does your household think about plastic? Have you tried reducing your usage? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And let's bring in a caller. We have Marsha from Allentown on the line. Marsha, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My comment is actually about the surprising places that we find plastics in our lives. I was really surprised when I really thought about how when I was getting my acrylic nails done, that's all plastic. But what was really surprising and shocking to me was when I was recently learning to knit and finding that the most affordable yarn that I was buying was acrylic yarn. And so I Googled, what is acrylic? And I actually watched a YouTube video about how they create acrylic yarn, and it is all plastic. Wow. And so all of those sweaters and things that we buy that are acrylic sweaters, we're wearing plastic, which is kind of disgusting if you think about it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, eventually those things are ending up in landfills, yeah, where they're never going to go away. So, yeah, acrylic is surprisingly everywhere. So even though we're switching over to our glass, you know, containers and even buying glass milk bottles from the local dairy, if you've got acrylic stuff in your house or you're knitting with acrylic yarn like I was doing,
thank you.
That's not quite what I was wanting to do.
Yeah, thank you. That's Marsha from Allentown. I think about acrylic paint. I think about so many things that we have plastic in. And so, Jenna, I wanted to sort of like, because one of the things that in researching for the show, I realized that there are some good uses to plastic, right? They help preserve our foods, all sorts of things. So could you tell us some of the good things, and then how do we separate the misuse, the extraneous use of plastic that we probably could decrease significantly to help with all the waste that we're seeing across the world?
Yeah, I think we should think about where, how, and when to use it, right? Be more intentional. Durable goods, they're called that way by the US EPA. They're in use for long periods of time. However, and that could be like the furniture, you know, that you're sitting in, you know, those items still create microplastics. So, you know, I think you would, and we are still not, you know, we don't have a great understanding of the full health impacts to us from microplastics. One of the callers brought up the fiber shedding from washing clothes. So I don't know. When you say good use, I mean, there's really functional uses of it that we rely on right now. But in almost all of those scenarios, we're creating pollution with our use of it. And so I still think, you know, again, we need to be intentional about that. I love Elisa's work, and Philly is so lucky to have programs like that, because many, many cities don't have projects like that. And so having access to that kind of program for restaurants and businesses, that can really have an impact. So that's really impressive. And this can expand on a city by city basis. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see things changing. Every little sort of city at a time.
Let me bring in another caller. This is Kathy from Emmaus, who has been waiting patiently on the line. Mm-hmm. Kathy, what's your perspective on this conversation?
Well, I'm not going to address what I do, because I do a lot of stuff and reuse and take my own takeout containers back to the, you know, when I go out, so I don't have to get a new one. But my concern is that, you know, everybody, there was a big push to do corn-based and bamboo-based. And if you do research, corn-based is plastic, and it doesn't degrade. It has to go into another special facility with high heat, And you can't just throw it in your garden and compost it in your garden. So that's my concern. I don't know a lot about bamboo, but I assume based on the fact that it is also cellulose-based, that it probably is similar.
Yeah. So I've heard this concern, Alisa, that, and thank you for that call, by the way, Kathy, that the alternatives have their own byproducts, their own problems that come with them. Maybe it costs a lot of carbon to produce and ship them. Maybe they don't really degrade unless under really ideal circumstances, which generally don't exist in the real world. What can you tell us about some of the more prominent sort of like one-to-one plastic replacements and how one determines whether it's actually a net positive to use that instead of plastic?
So about 20 years ago, I actually like did some repping for these like bioplastic companies. And at the same time, we had a farm and we had like, we were collecting the stuff and I saw firsthand how they didn't break down. So, but in more recent years, there's an organization called the Center for Environmental Health. And several years ago, they did research where they pulled all of the products, the most, you know, largest companies, I won't name them, but they pulled them and they sampled them. And what they found was that 75% of those packages contained PFAS. So for people on who are listening who don't know, PFAS also is called forever chemicals. They bind to lead. They create a lot of problems, public health issues. They're in the water stream. They're in Teflon. So where I call, you know, these compostable materials expensive garbage because businesses will pay a premium to switch over, but we don't have the infrastructure in place. And also there's this like public health component where they now are producing like PFAS free compostable wares, but then they'll test them and they'll
So you
they'll
sound
find
pretty skeptical about most of the replacement stuff that's out there.
Highly skeptical.
So
yeah.
So then it goes back to this conversation of basically not using things that are single use.
Yes.
Like that's where you start.
Yes, disposability is probably the pinnacle of our problem. Like disposability in our, you know, and I said it's we're enculturated for it, like that is true. And especially like the Jenna brought up, you know, the whole thing, like how are we using it? When we're thinking about plastics in an airplane or plastics in a vehicle, it can make the vehicle, the airplane, more efficient and lighter in weight. And that can be really positive. But when we're thinking about food packaging, that's a whole different category. That and then something that is avoidable if we start moving towards reuse. If we're doing, you know, now somebody had mentioned like move in every city that these things are turning up in every city. There are more and more businesses. There's a company called Bold Reuse, which is moving entire stadiums towards reuse, and they're being very successful. And the stadiums are saving money doing this. So I think that that's really what we need to be like.
Because I guess if you switch everything from plastic to just say bamboo, let's throw an example out there, and then you just had to produce in large monocultures tons of bamboo, like it feels like you're just creating some other problem to swap in for the plastics problem. Or am I being too skeptical here, Maury?
No, you're being absolutely right. I mean, we've been doing this for 50 years, thinking that we can solve one environmental problem by implementing some new technological innovation.
Some sort of swap. Yeah.
And what we end up doing is we end up moving problems from one domain to another. So we convert air pollution problems into solid waste problems, and we convert water pollution problems into climate problems. And so, you know, it's become common or increasingly common in some circles, you know, to invoke this idea that we are living in the era of a polycrisis, that all of these problems are interlinked with one another, and that trying to differentiate climate from plastic pollution, from other environmental sources of dismay, you know, is ultimately an artificial construction. These are all problems that are inherently interrelated, and we need to think as we started off this discussion, thinking about these issues as part of an entire system.
Yeah. Let me bring in a couple callers back to back. We have Goldsheed from Abington on the line. Goldsheed, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective on this conversation?
Interesting. One of your guests said that we're enculturated to this disposability. And I think one area that I'm concerned about is the use of these kind of disposable plastics in schools. For like school lunches, I visited my kids' school for this lunch event, and I noticed there were bags and bags of these styrofoam plates and things being thrown out at the end of lunch hour. So I just kind of wanted to see what the guests had to say about how we can tackle that in the school area, because that's a lot of kids that are, you know, using disposable plastic tableware every day.
And I wanted to piggyback what Goldsheed's question about schools with one that Rachel has from Philly. Rachel, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective on this conversation?
Well, when I walk through stores, especially big box stores, I always contemplate what landfill all of this is going to end up in. And I make my purchase choices based on trying to avoid that. And I have a lot of efforts that I make to not have reused plastics in my home. I reuse plastics if I can, string bags, all those kinds of things. But the one particular example that really hit me yesterday was I went to the drugstore, tried to buy soap. I couldn't buy bar soap because they only had a few brands that didn't work for me. And the entire aisle was filled with plastic bottles of liquid body wash.
Yeah.
Now, that's something that the vendors could make a choice about. You know, hopefully consumers make that choice, but the vendors could make that choice, or the drugstores could make a choice not to carry those items.
Yeah, that's Rachel from Philly. I mean, and those two, Rachel's and Goldsheed's questions, to me in my mind, go together, because you have people being indoctrinated at the school level, right, to have this disposability culture. And then you go to the store, you try to do things, and there's no options for you. And so how do we begin to sort of shift the culture away from this, and so that individuals can really, and collectively, we as a society, can start to wrap our heads around this and make a shift? And Alisa, you're sitting right here. I wonder if there's a way that we can sort of collectively stop indoctrinating ourselves to sort of shift to this disposability culture. Your thoughts?
I think a lot of it does start with education. I used to work with some youth in West Philly, and I had this amazing student that came to me at the end of our session, and they said, "Miss Alisa, I never thought about plastic one day in my life. Like, I didn't know where it came from, what it was made out of. And now that I know, I can't unsee it." So I think that it starts a lot with awareness and also like accessibility. Like the caller said, like, if you don't have an alternative, you're locked into the system. And what I implore everybody to do is start to do a little bit more research of like the public health aspects of these materials, because what they're finding is that a single 12-ounce hot cup or paper cup that has a plastic lining can leach up to 250,000 microplastics. We're putting hot liquids in there and then drinking it. We wonder, like, why is everybody sick? Because these are endocrine disrupting chemicals. So I think the more that people arm themselves with knowledge, then they can start going to their favorite restaurant or their grocery store and like starting to voice their concern. Like, why is this store full of so much plastic? And the more that people do that, and the more that they ask for alternatives, or the more that they say that they don't want so much of this disposable stuff in their marketplace, then I think businesses will start to heed that, because businesses don't change because their patrons do not demand it.
You see it even at the schools. You're like, don't give this to the kids. Yeah.
Real quick, Jordan from Philly on the line. Got to keep it brief, Jordan. We're toward the end of the show, but what is your perspective on this plastic conversation?
Yeah, hi. Just a question for the guests. Actually, on the BHYY, on a different segment, I actually heard that scientists came up with a microbe that either breaks down or eats plastic. And I was curious if this is like a viable solution for the plastic waste issue,
mm-hmm.
or would it just be a distraction from the real issue of our dependence on plastics?
Yeah, real quick, Jenna Jambeck, do you have a thought about knowledge of this microbe solution, biological solution to plastic waste?
Yep. Jordan's instinct is right. It's a distraction. It's really hard to get plastics collected together. So there's been a lot of technologies and engineers come up with, you know, ideas on how to treat plastics, but we still have the issues that we have now, which is even collecting all of the waste that's being generated. So I think they're interesting if people start to think about the issue from it, but we really need to work upstream with like the stuff that Elise is doing and thinking about the systems change that Maury said. So it's kind of a bit of a distraction unless it's a hook to get people to think about this issue and how to make change.
So if we, as we wrap up, I mean, one thing that everybody can do to sort of reduce their plastic, you know, use, you know, we'll start with you, Elisa, if everybody can give one and take as quickly as you possibly can.
So have definitely roll around with your reusable cup. You know, if you're going to a coffee shop, it is legal right now, food code wise. You can put, you know, give
your reusable cup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Write to your state legislatures and engage the political system because that will have a multiplicative effect.
And final word, Jenna.
Similar, I think, reach out to your stores. And if you can't find what you're looking for and you want less plastic, really communicate that to them.
That was Jenna Jambach, professor of environmental engineering at the University of Georgia and a 2022 MacArthur Fellow, for her work investigating plastic pollution. Jenna, thanks for the time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Let me also thank Maury Cohen, professor at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and editor of the journal Sustainability, Science, Practice, and Policy. Maury, appreciate you being here.
Well, great. Thanks for having me.
And finally, Elisa Shargorodsky, director of Ecosystems, a Philly-based nonprofit focusing on reuse and reducing waste. Elisa, appreciate the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you to everybody who called in. Lots of folks wrote in as well. Thank you for your commentary. And of course, we have to thank our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. And tomorrow at noon, how secure will the midterm elections be? A recent Gallup poll found that 2/3 of Americans are worried about ineligible voters, ballot counting, and fear political leaders will pressure officials to change election outcomes.
And President Trump is asking the U.S. Supreme Court again to allow restrictions on mail-in ballots, even though the election is just 3 months away. Yes, we're getting closer. We'll talk about all of that tomorrow. But coming up next on WHYY, it's Here and Now.